is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have with me today Brittany Spanos from Rolling Stone. Hey, Brittany.
Hey.
And John Dolan from Rolling Stone. What's up?
Hey.
So, you may have noticed that we are almost at the end of 2016, and what a year it's been. In addition to other events, there was some music released this year, and we just put out our list of the top albums of 2016. I want to talk about putting this list together and also just the general, what was this year like in music? What do you think sums up this year in music, Brittany?
I mean, so many big artists released an album this year, which was really crazy. I mean, we had new music from Kanye, from Beyonce, from, you know, David Bowie, and just like everyone who is a massive presence in pop music and the mainstream music world especially. It was a big year to see these massive and incredible albums from
right. Rihanna, Drake, like every sort of top current pop thing kind of had came out with something. Mm-hmm. Britney even, you know,
yeah,
like everyone.
Gaga,
Gaga.
Everyone had something this year.
John, you were saying before it was a pretty strong year, right? I mean,
I think this year, considering sort of how everything else in the year was so terrible, like if you looked at politics, if you looked at just everyday life, if you looked at celebrity deaths, it's like there was nowhere to go to sort of feel any sense of solace or any sense of kind of escape or any sense of, music, I think, was phenomenal this year. It was a year that had, it was hard to make this list. There were so many albums. In making our singles list, which is also in this issue, that was also incredibly hard. It's just, it was a remarkable year for music, especially the way music, I think, mirrored the year and kind of almost combated the year. I mean, all these albums are, some more obliquely than others, are in conversation with the social events of the year. Just,
yeah.
And, you know, we can go through the list and talk about how that happens. But it was a year where I feel music not only helped us kind of, it was a place to go where we could escape, but it was also a place where you could kind of have resilience and confrontation, which was also obviously important. It's more important as the year got on, obviously.
Do you guys think in lists, now this is an interesting thing. Now I'm not a music critic. I've sometimes played one in print, but it's not really my strength. I'm in an interesting place as someone who does a substantial amount of my writing is about music, but I really do prefer interviewing people. And it does involve some critical thinking, obviously, thinking like a critic, and I've written music criticism, but there's the way my brain works, I realize, is outside of the way many music critics work. And I don't think if you guys exemplify there's a kind of music critic who thinks in lists constantly. They're like, this was my top 10 singles of like this month, and they can just, you know, what was it? How about 1998? And mm-hmm. They can do that.
Right.
Do you guys think naturally in lists, or is it something that you have to kind of apply yourself to that?
I mean, sort of in short form list. I feel like mostly with singles, I think that way. Like every week I'm like, okay, these are the singles I've been listening to a lot.
Okay.
Or like, this is like the top songs. And even those though, sometimes end up being like a mixture of like new and old stuff. So my brain is kind of it's not thinking of that constantly. It's not in a very like, you know, linear or organized way.
How about you, John?
when I first started, you know, being a music critic, a rock critic, that was something I put a lot of thought into. The Village Voice would do its peasant job. Every year they do this critics poll where every critic sends in their top 10 albums and their top 10 singles and their top 5 reissues and their top this EPs and whatever. And you spend all this time going over it and over it. And I noticed as the years progressed, I cared less about it until the point where I stopped doing it. But like, I just definitely think lately in my life, because the thing is it's changeable. I mean, your aesthetic choices just in life are going to be going back and forth. Your life changes, your needs change. And I think this idea of a kind of a white room place where you can put the top 10 albums like it's a laboratory is kind of absurd. And I mean, eventually you do make a call and say, I guess this is we made our call. But I think this, what's nice about our list is it's a collaboration. It's not just one person mm-hmm. goes, here's what they are. We talk about it and we come up with it and we kind of leverage opinions and things like that. And so I guess I think that it's a little bit of a fool's game. It can be a fun fool's game.
Yeah.
But I do think that like it's good. What I like about doing this one is we do it together.
Yeah. It's interesting. You were saying, John used to work at Spin Magazine back when it was a magazine.
Right.
And you were saying in the year 2000, you guys chose to, you made Kid A number 2, and what did you make number 1?
Well, the funny thing, we were sitting around in this meeting and we were looking at the records that had come out, and I think it says a lot about the times that like, we decided that nothing seemed like the number one album, which in retrospect is nuts because Kid A and Stankonia both came out that year. So we were like by Outkast. So it was like clearly the defining album of the 21st century came out, and we were like, well, I don't know. Is it really? So we picked, because this is when kind of the Napster had just kicked in and we thought we were being clever, and we the number one album, we called it Your Hard Drive, and we put a picture of a Mac on the number one slot because it was like, you know, it was supposed to be like empowering the reader and the fan or whatever.
Was it like a bubble iMac?
Like, it was the pink thing, like, you know, it was kind of like when Details magazine put a reader on the cover. It was like, we're going to, you know, really have democracy in action. But it was like, that was our notion. And like, you know, I guess in a certain way, it was, as stupid ideas go, it was like kind of ends up being, it is what has happened. I mean, that is the history of music in the last 15 years. But Kid A is a pretty good album.
Yes. The other reason I bring that up is because we were also talking about, so there was a thing like, yeah, Your Hard Drive, it was like the atomization of music into not even singles, just like discrete songs. That was a thing that seemed to be happening. And then, as both of you guys mentioned, one of the big changes has been streaming is now overtaking downloads, and streaming does seem to be more album friendly, right?
Yeah. I think also just the idea of the album as an event has come back a lot. And I mean, I think that definitely came from Beyonce releasing her self-titled as a surprise release, and I mean
and things like Daft Punk, like the way Daft Punk kind of like re-embraced the throat. It was a thing that I think started a couple years ago, but
a lot of comebacks. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's really turned the album at a time when singles were becoming just the greatest point of like the hierarchy of music, but it like made it an event again. It made it something to be excited for, and also kind of like fearful of when someone was going to drop something in a lot of ways.
Oh, as journalists,
maybe
absolutely,
mostly for us,
yeah.
But like,
yeah.
I think that's pure. It's so funny. I think that music journalists have like have the most distorted thing. But yeah, it's like I think they have basically like PTSD about a surprise album drops, because it's always like, you know, Christmas Eve. Guess what? Like Bruce Springsteen and Beyonce released an album together. Surprise! It's like, no.
We need the review up in an hour. We got to hurry up. It's like, this is, people are talking about this. No, I mean, what Brittany says is really true. I mean, you know, I do think that if we dial it back, say, 5 years, I think there was a sense that the music, the way people were, iTunes and sort of things like that and downloading had atomized music to the point where, like, cohesive works were kind of just, especially cohesive achievements that everyone kind of gathers around, it was kind of a thing of the past. And there was just like, we would do these lists. I remember a couple years ago doing this one and being like, boy, I feel like every record on this list could be number four. But now I feel like the Beyonce album being, I mean, there was a time I think where I felt like an album like Lemonade probably would never happen again.
Yeah,
like, so just having that kind of space, like, it is remarkable how close it is. Like, there was just a sense, well, there'll never be another Nevermind, there'll never be another London Calling, there'll never be another Highway 61 Revisited. And this album is literally all those albums. It's, you know, it's she is kind of, this is a great album year, probably the best album year maybe since the 90s, and it's capped off by a classic, a true classic album, a five-star album that will, you know, that stands, will stand the test of time the way those other records did.
Yeah, let's step back and make it clear that our number one album of the year, and we'll be kind of going through the list in a weird, inscrutable order, I promise. But we will start at number one in the number one album of the year, I think, by total consensus among like literally everyone who has even the vaguest connection to Rolling Stone. I didn't ask Cameron Crowe, but maybe. That Lemonade by Beyonce is the number one album of the year. The other thing is, right, no one, like, literally no one disagreed with this,
even,
right?
Like, you know, like Stereo Gum, an indie website put up there, it's number one there. It'll be number one, I assume, on Pitchfork, unless they try to do something silly. But, like, it's going to be the number one album.
I'm not familiar with the side, should we know? I'm just kidding.
Well, you know,
You know what's fascinating, too, is building on, like, that, our conversation about, like, the singles and everything, like, Beyonce and Rihanna, Drake, like, those artists were, like, the the leaders of singles based music. I mean, like, they built off of having number one hits or like having these massive unavoidable singles. And, you know, looking at our list, like, they released some of the most solid like bodies of work this year, which is fascinating to see it, that change, especially like Beyonce in the last couple of years. I think people weren't expecting that shift for her.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think it's interesting. I mean, with Rihanna, I think, and, you know, we'll probably get to it, but Rihanna, I think, definitely wanted to be seen as an album artist with the album she put out. I personally am not totally convinced by Rihanna, the album artist, versus, like, I just don't think she's anywhere in the league as an album artist mm-hmm. of Beyonce or Solange or anyone else with the last name Knowles. No, but well, no, I mean, like, yeah. no, but or like a lot of other people, Frank Ocean, whatever. I just, yeah. I it feels a little bit like someone trying something that's not necessarily, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, but going back to it, man, Beyonce, how much does she get it? Just get it as far as, like, what a great album is. This is someone, you know, it's interesting. I was preparing for a possible Beyonce cover story, which maybe will still happen. Come on, Beyonce, we want to. And so I was really, really preparing. One of the things I did was I read I think it's the Tamborelli book on Beyonce, and it, which is, you know, I actually kind of recommend it. It really... Mm-hmm. Because one of the things it does is it draws from the depositions from all these Destiny's Child lawsuits. And in these depositions, you have, like, massive amounts of under oath descriptions of exactly how Destiny's Child started, exactly what the road was to Beyonce. And for Beyonce, and Beyonce went through a homemade version of, like, a Motown training school in the mm-hmm. 60s. Like, and she is steeped in the history of popular music of yeah. the 20th century. And I think she, you know, I think we've talked about this. This album is so many different kinds of albums. And I think it's also, I would say, a very deliberate statement on her part. A statement that, you know, people talk about Beyonce in, like, went from talking about Beyonce to talking about, like, Beyonce in all capital letters, you know, like, just as this, like, goddess, basically. And I think when people start talking about you that way, there's a few ways you can react. Is you can sort of run and hide.
The Dylan model.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you can, right, exactly, you know, and or you can, like, freak out.
the Michael Jackson model.
Or, well, yeah, there's a few other, you know, yeah. or you can be like, you know what, you can say, you know what, maybe the stuff I did wasn't quite justifying the way they're talking about me. I'm going to make something that actually lives up to the way that people, to what people should be expecting from it.
Well, the organic progression from her, of her career, as you kind of describe it, is going from, like, you're in a girl group, then you're this dominant singles artist, then the singles start to take on, like, Single Ladies, a little more of a biographical quality, and you start to show more control of your career and more control of your image, and then you start to show more of a sense that you want to make work with new artists and new producers and make kind of maybe more ambitious works, and then arriving at this record, which is on so many levels, like, it, not as you know, first of all, it's a collection of songs that are all great, but as, like, it's got autobiography, it's got politics, it talks about music history, it talks about regional history, it seems to hit everything you'd want. You know, she plays with her image on the record too, because there was, you know, the sense, is she really talking about her marriage? Is she making a game out of her marriage? Is it about masks and things like that? Everything you want from a record is on this thing. It's mm-hmm. like one-stop shopping for all the reasons we like albums.
She literally, there's a country song.
Yeah, and then, yeah, there's a Jack White song.
And a rock song.
And a rock song, yeah, and a Jack White song. And I like how Jack White is the genre where you're saying rock. We're like
Jack White.
Love that Jack White stuff. Yeah, that's my favorite Sirius channel.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so fascinated by celebrity and how celebrities use that in their music and their art that they create. And I think Beyonce, as someone who, I mean, with the release of her first surprise album, and I think, you know, kind of surprise, I mean, this one was kind of a surprise, but her first, like, actual surprise album, that really established her mm-hmm. as the all caps Beyonce. And I think what she did with that, I mean, releasing Formation and releasing such a political song, which we constantly, I mean, the demand of fans is that celebrities speak out, especially in the last few years. And
yeah.
we demand that more and more, and we notice more when people don't say anything. And for Beyonce to make a song about police brutality and make it set in New Orleans and to make this huge statement was so shocking.
Especially At the Super Bowl.
Yeah. And, like, as someone who never was really political, I mean, too much. I mean, she doesn't do a lot of interviews and a lot of things, like, where she has that sort of way of doing that. But, I mean, to make that such an important aspect of this album overall, this album that's about so much about, like, Black love and Black legacy, and I mean, this being steeped in history. I mean, I wrote something about her reclaiming the Black female rock tradition.
Yeah, that was a great piece. I was going to mention that. Yeah, no, she reclaimed a big area of musical history mm-hmm. and kind of, like, I think she picked
and
up
country,
the stream.
I mean, that comes a lot from the blues and Americana, which was also pretty much created by black women. And I mean, the voices of black women created a lot of those genres. And for her to take that, and I mean, that was so controversial for so many people. And I mean, those are two of my favorite songs on there.
Yeah, I mean,
Don't Hurt Yourself and
she makes
Daddy Lessons.
Those genres, though, all seem so natural. Like when she was on the CMAs or whatever, or when she goes on and does these things at a sort of a spectacular event, like such a normal American 50-yard line event as the Super Bowl, she's able to kind of, like, the way she kind of made feminism this word that, like, you know, I don't know, what I have a good friend who was a high school teacher and teaches high school English, and like when she would say, you know, oh, you know, feminism, these, like 20 years ago, there would be a real reaction. But then when Beyonce basically sort of has entered these ideas back into mainstream discourse and has made, she's just so good at sort of taking the culture around her and making it her own, very much in like a Bowie way, very much in a, you know, I guess in a Springsteen way as well, because she obviously gets so much warmth from the kind of, from her many, many audiences. I mean, it's a real achievement to be able to take things that are controversial or subversive and make them seem everyday and normal and kind of beloved in culture.
An interesting point about Beyonce and rock music is that there was a moment when Destiny's Child lost that talent show that I think is actually, there's a moment that maybe
she uses it
on the album. They lost it to like a hair metal band, and she really took note of that, from what I understand. And so she was like, "I'm taking that shit on too. Like, I'm like nothing is not mine, you know." And I think that's one of the many fascinating things about that. So we're talking about the greatest albums of 2016. We're gonna take a break and be right back.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Came into this world, daddy's little girl. Daddy made a soldier out of me.
So, you guys, is the Moana soundtrack on the best albums of the year?
Should be.
Number 51. Oh, okay. Just barely
okay.
To make the...
Because I'm really... I must say I'm really digging it right now. So we were talking about Beyonce. And the other thing about Beyonce is that her sister made one of the other great albums of the year.
Yeah.
Solange. And that's what, number 11 on our list?
I'm looking right now. Okay. I'm turning pages.
You
I know
can
this
hear
isn't
pages,
very good for radio.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But this is how it is. Paper.
Yeah.
Number 11 it is.
Yeah.
Brittany wrote the blurb, so she should talk about this right
now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, we've been talking. I keep bringing this up. It's so weird that two siblings would separately make two of the best albums of a year is pretty much unheard of.
And two incredibly unique albums that stand on their own separately. Like it's very difficult in my head to compare them in any way because they're such personal experiences for both women and. Yeah.
I mean, listen, the Solange album is good enough that I saw someone was like dissing us for putting Beyonce as number one, but their take was it's not even the best album by a Knowles sibling.
Yeah.
and it's like, which is like whatever. But I mean it is interesting that it's good enough that someone could attempt to make that argument.
That's why God invented the internet for arguments like that. That's why.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and in a minute I want to hear a song from the Solange album. Mm-hmm. What should we play?
Cranes in the Sky, definitely.
Okay, cool. But I mean the Solange album is like a warm bath musically and really bracing lyrically, I would say.
I mean, Solange's musical journey has been so fascinating over the course of, I mean, coming out of the shadow of Destiny's Child and of Beyonce. I mean, she did a lot of sort of 70s retro-y soul in like the early 2000s. And then she had this massive turn in, I want to say 2012, where she worked with Dev Hynes, and she made an incredible EP.
Of Blood Orange, right?
Yes. Yeah. And she made an incredible EP called True, and that was this huge sort of indie rockish shift that she made.
She became like a hipster favorite and kind of augured this hipster interest in R&B that has become a huge thing. You know, and then kind of then basically said, if you don't know Brandy album tracks, like, stop weighing in my thing, because I'm not just for hipsters. I want to be, I'm in this continuum of R&B and you better know about it. But anyway, it was this
beautiful fusion of, like, there's a lot of Africana and a lot of R&B and indie rock and all fused together in her EP. And then, so it's been a while since she released any new music, and she'd been kind of teasing this album. She released she started her own label, and then all of a sudden, the biggest surprise, or I mean, one of the biggest surprise musical twists of the year was Solange releasing A Seat at the Table, which is this incredible, another story about Black legacy and about her experience dealing with the sort of depression that came with diving into her emotions for this album, and about Black womanhood, and it's incredible.
I really love it. Can we play that one track?
I tried to drink it away. I tried to put one in the air.
I mean, there's a lot of really organic music making going on that record, a lot of live sounding instruments, a lot of, like, amazing, we didn't hear it so much in that moment, but some, like, amazing harmonies that I like even better than what Beyonce does, you know. There's obviously a deep gene for harmony, among other things, in the Knowles family. We were saying, back to the sibling thing, I mean, it's like, it's basically unprecedented. John was saying, it's like if the Gallagher brothers
were both left and were both good, both amazing. Or I think you brought the Jacksons, you mentioned, I mean, it's like if Thriller and Control came out the same year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very much like that. So it's just incredible. I mean, and there, you know, it speaks to that Knowles, that, you know, don't mess with the Knowles sisters, really.
I mean, they're so different. Oh, sorry. They're just the way these records are. It's true. You don't even need to mention them together, and that's what's kind of amazing about it. I mean, the Beyonce record comes at you so hard with so much, and it's so, basically her thing is just, you know, kind of, she just dominates you with this record. The nice thing about, like you say, it's the musical mood of this record is relaxed, even if the subject matter is incredibly intense and difficult and like you say, bracing. And I think that kind of fits with a lot of the theme of some of the records, especially in R&B right now, this new expansive, ambitious, album-oriented. And, you know, and records, the Frank Ocean record, which is on our list number 4, it's very similar where it kind of is asking you to spend time with it. Like, this is, you know, like it's asking you to live in it. And because in the streaming era, this gets back to the streaming iTunes streaming downloads thing, is, you know, you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So you can really just have a relaxed conversation with it without this agonistic relationship that used to happen with albums. They, you know, especially in R&B, where for so long it was the most commercially hidebound style of music. It was like based on singles, it was based on radio, it was based on videos. Now it's kind of entered this era of freedom, which is not unlike what it did in the early 70s.
Yeah, we were talking about this yesterday. There's obviously huge precedent for an era of great R&B albums, and it's the 70s, you know, and it's like, I mean, that's the, for politically engaged, ambitious, concept-y R&B albums, we're really returning to that era of the 70s.
And that was about artists getting freedom from a commercial hierarchy as well, when Marvin Gaye was like, I'm going to make this record, I'm going to do it here, I might do it somewhere else, but I'm going to make what's going on, and you're going to have to deal with it. And he did it, and it entered this whole new era where other artists could do it, you know, as well. And this is kind of the same thing of just, once the sort of strictures of the industry are gone, you can see freedom happens. And this is a year I think this really came to fruition in a lot of different ways.
And of course, also, I mean, it's the legacy of Prince and a million other artists who weren't in the 70s. But there's just something about the commonality it's just reminding me of what's going on.
Yeah, the legacy of Sign of the Times on all these records is there.
That's the other, right? If you want to go more recently,
These are all albums that really demanded you to listen twice. Like, I don't think I've heard such a string of albums that really demanded you to, like, sit down and, like, listen to them, because it just, like, everything just made so much sense together. And, like,
how do you guys listen to albums, like a whole album?
On the subway?
Okay.
Yeah. The train is my favorite place to listen to.
See, this is where my bike commute is screwing this all up, because I would die if I listened to an entire album on another thing. So it's an interesting thing, because I can't concentrate on an album while I'm working. Mm-hmm. Not really. I can't listen to, like, a whole album if I'm really writing. So it's just tricky. I walking is a thing. Like, when I walk, it's my favorite thing.
Or exercising. At your computer usually, or at somewhere, and you've got streaming thing open, and you're kind of doing that, and it's so easy to kind of bounce around. You do have to be somewhere isolated. Like, the nice thing about the subway is eventually you can start the album, and at certain stops you go under and you don't get any service anymore, but the thing keeps playing. So you're stuck with it. You can't, you can't move around. So like today I was listening to Frank Ocean. I was like, this is, I'm in this thing. I'm sitting in it. And it was a good way to do it because attention spans are terrible now, including mine. And it's good to be, and he's thinking, I spent 4 years on this. You can spend an hour.
Right.
And so it works out that it ended up being a great experience. And it's happened before. And I think a lot of these albums, I mean, the Kanye record is like this as well. Mm-hmm. They need you to be with them.
Yeah. I think, for a lot of people in the rest of the country, it's driving, which is the ideal.
Yeah.
Like a long drive is the ideal way to listen to an album. But it is an interesting thing that I think people don't talk about much is like, how do you accommodate this? And, it's like when I talked to David Gilmour about Dark Side of the Moon, he was saying that like the way they pictured it is, people, you sort of dim the lights, you put on the LP, you sit down and you probably get super high and you listen to the album and obviously there were things about the LP era, and obviously people listen to vinyl now,
especially that demand your
attention, because you're putting the thing on. It's like you went to all this trouble.
Yep.
You better listen to it.
No, I noticed that I got these Kings reissues on vinyl and I had this happen last night. I'm playing these records. I'm listening to these records more than I usually do, more than I have in the past.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, especially when I'm reviewing an album, I like to listen to it off my headphones at least twice. Yeah. Actually see if it fills a room, if it sticks out to me, if it can grab my attention enough from whatever else I'm doing, or if I get too distracted. Like, is this album going to like make this room, everything in this room stop?
Right. Well, I mean, it's funny. There's not a music critic, but there's a thing, a very basic thing. When I'm sort of, if I'm just checking whether I think something's worthwhile or whether, I'm putting on a new album, it's like, do you want to keep listening to it without thinking about it? Is it calling to you to like pay attention to it and keep listening to it? And that's like a very basic thing that I think sometimes maybe some music critics who are looking for things that are very difficult and very complicated sometimes forget, like, do I really want to listen to this, or is this is it more interesting than it is?
I mean,
good,
that's why you should behave. I mean, before you write about something or start to put your thoughts together, unlike watching a movie, unlike reading a book, you have to play it 5 or 6 times because it's shocking what you will notice. Just really like notice literally about it, but also just see, then you really can tell not just if it's good or bad, but how it kind of lives with you in your life. Like you're saying, like if you're doing the dishes and something strikes you or whatever it is, that's when you, because music is, it's in people's lives in a way that these other art forms, they're not.
Is the flip side of streaming that it's harder to, and this is more about the digital era in general. On the one hand, yes, it's easier to immerse yourself because it's right there, and you don't have to pay for individual albums. But it's also, what about the fact that like all of recorded music is available to you at any given moment? How does that affect attention spans and the ability to focus on new albums?
Well, I think it makes it a lot harder. I mean, that's why it's good to be somewhere isolated and just say, this is what I'm going to do right now. Take a walk, and do that kind of stuff, because it's right. If you're, and just the natural function of just the natural feeling of having a phone or sitting in front of a computer is inherently kind of makes you kind of zippy. Mm-hmm. And so you tend to want to bounce, like, oh, I listen to a few of these. I listen to this. I listen to that. And, you start making playlists and things like that. And I think you do have to go away from that a little bit and just kind of live with these things.
Well, I think my counterintuitive think piece that I just came up with is actually the availability of all recorded music against whatever your current thing is actually making music better, because people are like, I better make a freaking classic or else why would anyone listen to it when they can listen to what's going on with just as easily.
I mean, it's much easier to go with the single that you're sort of inundated with on radio or out whenever you're going and everything, and or to listen to whatever you're familiar with, like albums from when you were a teenager that you listened to all the way through. So it's like easier to go back to those than to be prone to listen to, except for us that we have to listen to but I mean for like the average person, I mean, just having to go to a new album is, it's like more difficult to do that.
Even at the same time, remember when you used to buy a record, you'd go buy a CD, especially at the height of CDs when they were so expensive, you were like, I'm going to make this thing work. I'm going to listen to it until it's good. And that was kind of a weird relationship. We were going to shoehorn it into being good.
Yeah.
Where now you can just be like, look, I'm going to judge this on purely aesthetic grounds. And that's a fun.
I didn't like this first time, and so I'm done.
I paid $18 for this, for this silver thing that is already scratched and skipping.
Yeah.
I hate CDs.
In the fear of all men, in the fear of all men, stands a solitary candle.
So our number one album was Beyoncé's Lemonade. Our number two album was David Bowie's Black Star, which is hard to talk about this album because it, you know, it basically came out and then a few days later David Bowie promptly passed away, and you know it obviously gains a lot of, I was going to say unexpected resonance, but not really unexpected, because basically what Tony Visconti told me is that Bowie certainly did not want to die. He was really trying to live, but he wanted Black Star just in case to be, you know, kind of an appropriate final album. But basically what happened was that you heard it, you realized that this was one of the greatest albums made by a veteran artist ever. And then as you were taking that in, yeah. Then you had to take in his death. So, I mean, overall, one of the most intense listening experiences of my entire life. It's also, like, fantastically creepy, as the video also. I mean, there's all this, tons of, like, Aleister Crowley stuff that he was returning to. But, you know, one of the things, there's so many things to say about this record. One of the things I have to say, and I really like the Radiohead record, which is a number 6, A Moon Shaped Pool. But in my opinion, David Bowie made a better Radiohead album than Radiohead.
He made more of a rock Radiohead album than Radiohead.
Yeah, 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 yeah. This album would be number 2 if he were alive and well, and we certainly would prefer that. This is far from a sympathy pick. I remember first putting this on, I think it was, you know, the first couple singles, and just literally laughing at how good they were. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, I mean, it's, his last album also was very good, but I mean, it is so rare for a guy at that point in their career to be making an album that is literally as good as their best work, and not even in a sort of grading on a curve way, but just like sounds totally current, totally essential, totally gripping and surprising, right?
Well, he was listening to, right up to, I mean, Bowie obviously always taking influence from what's happening throughout his entire life and always kind of fusing these things into his vision. And he was listening to the D'Angelo album that came out. He was listening to Kendrick Lamar. He was working with these kind of downtown jazz guys. He was just thinking in terms of the future as he was kind of officiating this, his own death, basically, this event. He was kind of projecting into what music will be like and sort of moving music ahead even up to the very last minute of his life, and you can hear that on this record. It's incredible. It's an incredible record.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that, you know, we have a bunch, we have some albums by veteran artists on this list. So we have David Bowie at number 2. We have the new Rolling Stones album, Blue and Lonesome, at number 7. And that's a super fun, super surprising album that they recorded in 3 days. So you can read, we had them on the show a couple weeks ago, and you can go hear them talk about the recording it. But you know, it's a blues album recorded super spontaneously. It sounds very alive, and you literally can't tell at points what year it is.
It really could be 1962. And you think of these guys are making, right, you know, the Chicago blues. It's like, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Little Walter and things like that. And you think of them; these are the records they talked about when they met each other.
Right.
Like when they, like, on the bus and they were like, what do you like? It's like, I've got these records. Can I come to your place and hear them? I mean, these are records they've, like, been living with now their entire lives. And now they're twice as old as the guys who made the records. So right. There's a sense when they're kind of like battling it out with these songs about, like, you know, love and betrayal and sort of, you know, they've got this wisdom to their performances that I think, you know, even though it sounds 50 years ago and raw, and really raw, surprisingly raw, like when I heard Dawn was producing, I was a little nervous, but it turns out to be a real raw record. They're bringing this kind of like veteran, not just veteran, you know, that's this musical skill, but emotional kind of ballast to these songs.
I think that's such a difficulty for a lot of artists who have careers as long as the Stones have, or Bowie. I mean, negotiating your history without repeating it is is a very difficult thing to attempt to do. And I think looking at Blue and Lonesome and looking at Black Star, and for Bowie, looking at The Next Day, which was his comeback album after his hiatus, and like looking at the way he negotiated his past and looking at the way the Stones negotiate their love for the blues, and I mean, covering these blues songs and turning them into something new and looking to the future with that history sort of balancing out.
Yeah, I mean,
really
another that's absolutely true. And the other example of that, I think, is the Paul Simon record, where he kind of is incorporating elements of things. I mean, there's 60s folk on it. There's Afro pop on it. He references his old songs on the record. It's kind of reinterpreting your own history throughout. You know, there's that is equally hard to do, and he does that extremely well on this record. I think we put it at 12.
Yeah, it's number 12 is Paul Simon's Stranger to Stranger. I mean, I would say that, you know, I prefer the previous Paul Simon record, which is, I thought, just incredible. I thought that was, like, sort of in the Black Star range of, like, wow, this is as good as, you know, your best stuff. And I think this one's very good, too. But in general, right, I mean, I think people give Rolling Stone flack for even kind of including some of these older artists. And I will say that there's a legit, in my opinion, a legitimate ageism in popular music discourse. I think that there's an assumption that basically it's very unlike, there was some headline on a website that will go unnamed as like, LOL, Paul Simon's alive and he made an album and it's actually not bad. And it's like, no, you know, it's like basically like, screw you. Like, why would you assume that a Paul Simon couldn't make a great record? Like, that is, there is a reason it's called ageism. You assume that there's a period of relevance and then basically you should just go away or just play your old songs. And I really think that, you know, one of the things, if anything, you know, the fact that we recognize these albums can now serve as a little bit of a corrective.
Yeah, and so, all these records deal, they're not afraid of that topic. They all talk about mortality.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like the Leonard Cohen one is kind of an anti-matter version of Black Star. It's like he's right while he was, you know, he's like, it's the same thing. And they're all, the Simon record mentions it a number of times. It's like, look, I get it, but like I have a lot of ideas and I have a wisdom I've accrued over these many decades. And, it, you know, they're not trying, like I think the problem in sort of other, you know, some of these guys, like whether it was Dylan or whoever in the 80s or maybe the 90s, were trying to be contemporary. There's even when Paul Simon is working with artists who are 50 years younger than he is or whatever, there's not a sense of trying to follow any kind of trend. There's just a sense mm-hmm. of taking the music around them that they like and hearing music they've heard. And just the Paul Simon record is influenced by Harry Parch, who was pre-rock, but it's also got a, you know, electronic music on it. So it's incorporating an organic sense of your world.
Well fascinatingly, right? Paul Simon, Leonard Cohen, and David Bowie's record are all like arguably hipper sounding than the Green Day album, which is also on our list at number 14. You know, these guys are like super older, in two cases literally not around anymore, but they were willing to, you know, embrace, there's tons of like really elaborate and inventive sampling work on the Paul Simon record. Tons of, I mean, you just heard on Bowie's Black Star, I mean, he was using something like Melodyne/Autotune to do these artificial mm-hmm. harmonies, which is very much in the vein of, you know, of Kanye or whatever, mm-hmm. it's a, you know, or Bon Iver or whatever. So it's just kind of funny. And then, I mean, and Green Day is like, I think is just a solid kind of rock album. And
but there's,
know,
a pleasure it, in yeah. that too,
of
especially
course,
now. It's yeah. like, it's just not happening anymore. It's like they went back to the music that people tend to, but you know, actually there's something about that too, where like, you know, it sounds a little more like Dookie. It's like them mm-hmm. Green Day being Green Day, but there's also a sense on the, I mean, he's talking about his life. He's talking about struggles he's had. He's talking about a sense of like kind of political things. And the music incorporates classic rock more than it used to. There's one song that kind of sounds like R.E.M. There's yeah. a 70s kind of ballad. Almost like yeah. you know, they're also sort of taking whatever their personal history is. I mean, it's dialing back 30 years, but I think that there's along with the basic pleasure of just like hearing a good rock album.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, don't forget, I mean, Dookie is now as old as like Who's Next was when Dookie
yeah.
came out. There's a point
yeah.
I made. I mean, which is, you know, still trying to get my head around that.
And also, what's really special is both of Billy Joe Armstrong's sons also released really excellent music this year, which is just like a really cool idea of like he released this album and then also his sons have.
Yeah, that Swimmer's record is good.
Yeah.
And like it's kind of funny that mm-hmm. that would work out that way.
Yeah, and the other son who's
Jacob Danger.
Jacob
yeah.
Danger, I think I like even better.
Yeah,
like,
really garagey.
Like, garagey cool
yeah.
stuff.
Burger
yeah.
Records. Yeah.
Seems,
really
yeah.
I get my kicks and I want to start raging.
I want to go back to like sort of number 25 and count down a little bit. So we have at number 25, we had Rihanna with Auntie, and we kind of talked a little bit about my ambivalence about Rihanna as album artist. What do you think, though?
I love this album.
Yeah.
I go back to it so much more than I thought I would.
And it has
yeah.
good singles. I mean, Works,
right.
yeah,
like, have
Kiss
a song.
It Better.
I mean, Kiss It Better. I mean,
yeah.
Some of the indulgences, though, feel after years of being like giving a single after single after single, they seem earned. It's like it's a fun. It's
Tame Impala cover.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. Yeah. It's like it's fun to see her take advantage of this.
The Tame Impala karaoke. No, just
yeah. but it's,
you know what I mean. I mean, she like,
yeah.
like, Rihanna did a ballsy thing, which is she just took the, I mean, you know, not took, like, but basically like used the original track and just sang over it, more or less, which is an interesting, kind of a cool, funny way to do a cover. Anyway, so then at number 24, Drive By Truckers, American Band, fun straight ahead rock album that really snuck up on me. I think I actually really like that. Mitski, Puberty 2, which is another like very different kind of rock album, but certainly one of the best guitar records of the year.
Yeah, and my favorite single from the year is Your Best American Girl, and I love that album too.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Bon Iver, which is a tough one for me. I'm still kind of deciding whether it's interesting, whether it's just interesting or actually good. what do you guys?
It's a tough one. I was listening to it today a little bit, and you know what he's doing. You're right. It's like trying to make his version of kind of a futurist pop album is a nice idea, and there are moments on it. It's definitely like you can. I'd say the album of on this list to put on while you're reading would be kind of like compared to the rest of these records seem to kind of jump at you, but this is definitely kind of a. Low-key affair, I guess.
I think it'd be too distracting while I'm reading. There's a lot of like weird shit on the album, which is good, but so I'm going to jump around a little bit. I mean, I really like the Danny Brown record. There's some really great stuff on it. There's one single on that that's truly fantastic. A group song that is really good. And then 1975, I really like. I actually got in an argument with Mick Jagger about it because I said I like them, but I think they're basically just in excess, and he felt that was too reductive. So anyway, Mick Jagger.
I'm on Mick's side.
I was sort of kidding, but then I realized that it's very interesting because what does in excess symbolize in the Mick Jagger mind? Because that was obviously a sort of a competitive Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
And so anyway, but I was like, well, you know, that's a compliment. But anyway, I do like that record. Sounds like you do too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I definitely love the sprawling experimental stuff that we talked about with like Frank Ocean and Solange kind of on there, but a lot of like great pop rock.
Yeah, and the world is a little bit short on that on the moment, so we need it. Parquet Courts, a Dolan favorite, I think.
Yeah, one of the probably the best indie rock band of the last few years. After making lots of music really quickly, putting out a few albums and teeming with ideas, and I felt this record kind of slowed down a little bit and had them kind of think about their lives and it kind of getting a little older, talking about New York, talking about relationships. It's got kind of a Dylan, Lou Reed kind of quality to it. I really it didn't jump out as much at me as much as their other records had, but it ends up kind of growing more.
And Miranda Lambert at number 16, The Weight of These Wings.
And it's
a really ambitious kind of post-breakup album, right?
Yeah, really incredible double album. I was very shocked at how well everything just worked together, and I mean, for the length of that album, every song is really solid.
I love that we still have an idea of a double album as if that really means anything. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like I'm surprised that there aren't more like sort of 7-hour albums, like for streaming. You know,
was that Grateful Dead thing is 5 hours long. There's a Grateful Dead tribute this year that was 5 hours of Grateful Dead.
Yes,
covers.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. I think that there will be someone's going to make a statement, and it's like this album is 5 hours long. You better sit and
good luck.
And it's all one track. Good luck. Yeah, yeah. Do you have the strength to listen to my album?
It is funny though the way she conceives it. Like there's albums with just as many songs, but she puts like if you look at it on Spotify, there was like 1, 2. There's 2 albums. You're supposed to think of it that way. You're supposed to be saying get the vinyl.
Totally. Right. She's such a hipster. And Level Up, which is like band that came out of nowhere for me. That's a fun band.
It is. Yeah. It is taking like the thing in indie rock and kind of underground rock has been '90s. Neo-90s, and they kind of do that. They sound like Neutral Milk Hotel and Built to Spill and bands from that era, but they give it an emotional urgency that's definitely their own. They're kind of the new Parquet, the upstart indie rock band of the year, I think you'd say. Yeah.
They're this generation's Parquet Courts.
That's right.
Like, the thing with Parquet Courts is I get mad when they said like they won't play their one like insanely mildly successful songs because like uncool people enjoyed it too much. I was like, come on, stop it.
Well, there's something quaint about that kind of orneriness. It's kind of like the 90s.
Yeah. It makes me want to like, no, screw that. And then... Yeah, that's mind blowing to me. And so we talked about Green Day at number 14, and I do, I really like the. There's little bits of, I found out that he's a Guided by Voices fan, and there you can actually hear that a little bit. They actually share some. It's weird. There's some sense that he's like an alternate universe Robert Pollard or something. There's like a little bit. They share, I think, some of the same influences. It's really interesting. I'd love to get those guys together.
Yeah, for sure. You're right. Anthemic rock, absolutely. Yeah.
Anyway, and then number 13 is an album I will fully admit in public I still have not heard a note of, but I'm excited to hear it because you guys love it. It's by a country artist named Maren Morris, and it's called Hero. And I'm assuming you guys didn't just make this up. This is a real album by a real artist.
Yes.
It's not a kids
can't
movie.
Confirm.
Yeah, it's a real life thing named Maren Morris. It is like, you know, country's been trying to look. Nashville, I think, has been looking for this golden mean between kind of like it's a little rock, it's a little pop. It understands that R&B and hip hop have happened. It's got guitars. This is so well done in that regard. It's got all that stuff. The songs are incredibly catchy. They're funny.
Yeah.
It's just it's a great record.
And just jumping around, we have Young Thug's Jeffrey at number 10. And I just really love the I really love this record. I personally lobbied really hard to make sure it was on the list and high on the list. It's just
so good.
I just don't understand how he does what he does, because it's like Future, who already is super spontaneous. He's like the even more spontaneous Future. It just seems to like pour out of him.
Yeah. So the only artist I would allow to have a song called Harambe.
And it's awesome. And it's like
a great song too.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we've been talking about the best albums of 2016. You should check out our new issue that has that, and download us at rollingstone.com/podcasts and listen to us next week on Friday at 1 p.m.